All right. Thank you, Holly and Calvin. Here we go. Well, many of you have already met David, gathered around the model. So let me give you an introduction to David. He's the program director leading the Lockheed Martin engineering, production and flight test team of the X-59 low boom flight demonstrator program. He's originally from Reno, Nevada, grew up flying as the son of a bush pilot and joined Lockheed Martin's advanced development program, Skunk Works, over 31 years ago as a conceptual designer in Burbank. His career has spanned responsibilities as design lead, air vehicle lead, chief engineer, project manager, technology, portfolio director, and program director. Over his career, David has worked fighter, transport, patrol, and bomber programs, as well as rotary wing, lighter than air, and unmanned systems. He holds a master's degree in mechanical engineering from Brigham Young University and speaks French and Tahitian. He and his wife, Deborah, live in Lancaster. They've got 4 adult children and 7 grandchildren. Aside from his passion for airplanes, his interests include photography, astrophotography, backpacking, fishing, and home improvement. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to David.
I'm going to move this just to move this so I can see what I'm talking about. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate being able to come here. As you can tell, I'm kind of excited about the airplane. I actually had a job before this where I had a portfolio of many different programs, and the X-59 was one of them. As things went on, there was issues that started coming up. And so the vice president over Lockheed Martin Aeronautics asked me to step down from my other job and to just focus on this one and to take over this. So I've been the program director of the X-59 program for about the last 4 years, but I've been working the program for about 7 or so. So the purpose of the X-59, I talked about how it is really designed to just make a noise, to make a sonic boom. But the requirements are is that we needed to develop an aircraft that was relevant, meaning that it was a manned airplane with traceability to a low boom aircraft so that we could go out and get sonic boom response data from the general public. And to see how they feel about sonic booms in their where they live. Back in the early 70s, the NASA, FAA, and the Air Force worked together to do some community responses for supersonic flight across the country. And so they had F-104s flying and making sonic booms everywhere. And some of you may have seen pictures of it in media where, you know, a woman's crying over her broken dishes or, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, the window's broken, the sightings come off the house. I don't know how low these pilots were flying when they did that, but we live up in the Antelope Valley and F-35s make sonic booms all the time. I've never had anything break. It is startling. And I do know for a fact that turkeys and some other things die when they hear sonic booms. But anyhow, what happened is that they made it illegal. And what we want to do is the exact same thing now with a quiet airplane to have people say, yeah, I can live with that. It's good. So that's the purpose of the airplane. But it has to be manned because they want to show traceability to an airliner of the future rather than some sort of a small little demonstrator that's not really relevant to an airliner. So if any of you are history buffs about airplanes, which I'm just a nut about aircraft, you know that starting out from the very beginning, airplanes flew about as fast as you could run. And then as time went on, they went faster and faster and faster. And in the 1950s, everybody wanted to go super fast. And at the beginning of the 60s and stuff, we could achieve that. And if any of you have ever seen the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, you'll see that they have this Pan Am space plane flying to this space station, and then they fly on to the moon. Everybody thought, oh, we're going to be flying into space. We're going to be flying to the moon. And here we are, 2023, and we're still not quite doing that commercially. But everybody thought that this is just going to continue, this trend. But what happened, and so if you look at this picture, we see the Concorde there, kind of in the lower middle. And the Concorde flew over Mach 2. And it made it so that people could cross the Atlantic in a few hours rather than half a day. But at the same time, there was an overland limit that was put in based on that community response that everybody had. And so the Concorde could not fly over the continental United States supersonic, which made it so it could only fly, over the ocean. And it made it very inefficient if it was going to fly from maybe New York to Los Angeles. A supersonic airplane designed to fly Mach 2 flying at around Mach 0.7578, which we do all the time, is like having a Ferrari and you just drive it in second gear and tow a 40-foot trailer behind you. It is very, very inefficient. And so economically, it was very difficult for the Concorde to actually make money. Actually, it never did because of the amount of fuel that it used and the limitations on where it could fly. So that was a problem for Concorde. It was good for the United States because we never had a supersonic transport, and that way we're saying, no, you guys can't use your supersonic transport here. So it was kind of a poke in the eye for the British and the French. But the other thing that happened, for those of you who are old enough to remember, is we had the first energy crisis in the early 70s, where OPEC basically raised the price of oil and it became very expensive. And there was this huge shock to the whole system. And after that, everybody wanted to travel, but they wanted a cheap ticket. And so all the airplanes that were developed and the engines that were developed were all about speed and cost optimization to make that ticket as low cost as you can do it. And all of us are beneficiaries of that. Every one of you has probably gone on some vacation that otherwise, 70 years ago you wouldn't do, or 100 years ago was just unaffordable, but we can do it today. So all the airplanes going down to the 787 there at the bottom are all about flying subsonic at the best cruise efficiency that you can. So I don't want to get too mathy here or anything else, but what we have here is a curve of the travel time. So the faster you go down at the bottom versus the time, which is the vertical axis, faster you go, the less time it takes. But the red curve is how much it costs for you to do that. And so the faster you go, the more expensive it is. Right in the middle, there is the line between supersonic and subsonic, and there's a bump. I'll go through and explain some of these here. But you see this flat area that's there at the top. All of us go down to LAX or someplace, and we have to park our car or else be dropped off. We have to go through security. We have to, sit there, wait for the airplane to board, which, takes a long time, but it's not as bad as trying to get off the airplane. We all hate that. All those sort of things take a certain amount of time. People who fly to Las Vegas, I don't understand, because they spend as much time going to the airport and everything else as it takes to just drive there. And that's what that flat is. No matter how fast we go, whether we go faster or whatever, it won't change that flat. And that's the world that we live in right now. Everybody will talk about an airplane that goes just a little bit faster, but it really doesn't help, because you end up flying behind airplanes and everything in the airspace that are going slower than you, and you all have to line up. That bump is what's called a transonic drag. And you remember when I was telling you about the Concorde driving in second gear with a trailer behind it? If it flies in that region, it is using a lot of gas. And so any airplane that wants to be supersonic, you want to get past that bump. Also past that bump on the right-hand side of it, where it sort of does, it's not, it's kind of a little dip there. It's Mach 1.2, 1.25. No matter what happens with any airplane, even the low boom flight demonstrator, every airplane makes a loud sonic boom there. We can't avoid it. So that's why we go past that and we fly a little faster. There was a company called Aireon that said, well, we're going to fly around and you won't hear our sonic boom. They're going to fly at Mach 1.2, 1.18, which again is still in that transonic drag rise, which is a bad spot, but you just didn't hear the boom coalesce down in the ground. If you go up on the far right-hand side and you're going really fast, the airplane uses something called an afterburner with the engine. It's basically you're just throwing buckets of gas into the engine and using that extra explosion of the fuel to propel you even faster. Because Concorde used afterburning to fly that fast, it was very expensive, used a lot of fuel. Also, it's just a torture on the airplane or the engine. The other thing is there's more complexities in the propulsion system. The actual inlet where the air goes into the engine has to actually change geometry in order to feed the engine the right kind of air going that fast. And that's a lot of, we call it claptrap. It's very complex, very expensive. And the other thing is the airplane actually heats up. And so we have to use other metals and materials to be able to fly that fast. So it's really expensive. And you see this kind of crossover point here where the cost and the speed kind of meet. They're around Mach 1.8. That's the sweet spot. Don't go any faster than that. But if you go that fast, you're getting as much time reduction as you can without paying a huge penalty by going faster. And that really is the sweet spot that we want to fly in. So we're trying to open up the door for us to fly fast again. Mach 1.8 is about twice as fast as you fly today. So think of any flight that you have. My daughter used to live in Japan, and we would go 9 hours over, 12 hours back. And halfway across the Pacific, you look at the screen, seeing where the airplane is, like, oh man, you know? And so think of it where it's going over is now 4.5 hours. I could do that. Coming back is 6 hours. Yeah, I can do that. You know, but going across now from New York to LA, you've probably done that coming westward. It takes a lot longer than going eastward, and it can just be a slog. But imagine being able to do that, you know, in just about 3 hours, in 2.5 hours. You can go have a meeting and come back and it's still morning, you know? And so it makes a big difference in people who travel a lot. It's not that everybody would probably buy these tickets, because they'd probably be about the value of first class right now. If there's more of these airplanes in the future, just like today, there's more airliners and things just get cheaper. The tickets would go down in time. So that's our goal, is to get to an airplane that flies that fast. So this is the chart where you're just gonna go blah, 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 because it's just, it talks about some of the technologies and some of the science that has gone on. Low boom technology is not new. This has been around since we really discovered sonic booms and started flying supersonic. I won't go through all of this, but the main thing here that I wanna talk to is, you'll see this thing that says area due to volume. There's a certain shaping that we need to have in order for us to go through the air nice and clean. And I'm gonna talk to that later. The other one is this equivalent area due to lift. To make a low boom, we wanna push the lift as far aft as we can. And I'll talk to that a little bit. But some of the tests that were done, you'll see this graph on the bottom right-hand side where you see all these little dots. The loudness is over on the right-hand side and the perceived decibel level is on the bottom there. So there's actually how loud something is versus what we perceive it to be. There are things that are pretty loud, but we think that they're okay. They don't bother us. But in testing people and finding out where do they have this objectivity or nuisance threshold to sound, it's really around about this 80 decibel, perceived decibel level. If you can get 80 decibels or lower, people really don't care. You guys hear the cars out on the freeway? So when I'm talking, you don't hear them so much, right? But if I'm quiet, you can hear them. Does it bother you? No, it kind of sounds like water. That's about how loud this boom would be if we're being quiet. It's something that you hear, but it's not something that bothers you, except it won't be a nice constant noise. It'll be kind of a thwomp sort of sound. If your neighbor next door to you slams his car door and you're sitting in your front room, you know, again, it's kind of muffled, but you hear it, but you'd really almost wouldn't even notice it. That's what we're shooting for. On the bottom, you see what's called an N wave. It's the sonic boom. If you ever hear a boom, boom of a sonic boom, it's that first part where the pressure goes up, and then it's the bottom part where the pressure recovers and you hear this boom, boom. Your ear perceives that pressure change. And it's very sharp. The N wave is very sharp. If we round those corners, you've all driven into a pothole, you know, bone jarring pothole. The pothole's pretty short. It's kind of deep. And you get this boom, boom as the tire goes down in it and then comes back out. If you were to take that pothole and kind of stretch it out, so it's still the same depth, but you make it so that it's wider and then you round the edges, it's just kind of a dip that you go into and it's not so annoying. That's what we're doing here with shaping this boom so that your perception of it isn't as bad as, actually it really is. It's still the same amplitude. It's still the same depth of a pothole. It's just that we make you go into it easier and out of it easier. Does that make sense? So NASA wants to demonstrate this low boom, and there's three phases to it. Right now we're in phase one. This is the aircraft engineering development, build and test. What it is that NASA's paid us to design the airplane. It's not a NASA design, it's a Lockheed design. We have the technology for doing the design. And we're building the airplane right now. It's about ready to go out and start the engine and then go into flight test later this year. Once we're done with flight test, we hand the keys over to NASA. NASA will then go and do phase two, which is an acoustic evaluation. They're going to go around and flying up at Edwards Air Force Base. They're going to have all of these microphones on the ground, and they're going to have airplanes chase it and fly really close to it and measure the sonic boom that it makes to verify that it's 80 dB or less. Requirement that we have is 75 dB is what the airplane has to be. And then there's phase three, and this is where they're going to take the airplane out of the Edwards airspace, and they're going to fly it around to different communities across the United States, from dense cities to urban areas to rural areas to places out, you know, in the middle of the wilderness, you know, mountains or wherever, to get people to respond to this. They're going to send out a lot of emails, and they're going to send out mail. They're going to say, hey, this airplane is going to fly over. We want you to respond. Here's the card. It's going to happen at this time on this day. And they're going to listen at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they're going to hear thwump. They're going to say, oh, I hate this. I love it, whatever it is. And then we're going to say, yes, going to come by tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And they're going to go out there, and they're not going to hear anything because we're not going to fly by. And then they're going to say, oh, I hate it. Then we're going to know that that person is a person that we're not going to listen to because they just hate it no matter what. But we want to make sure that we get the truth without people having some bias in it. So we're going to say we're flying, but we're not. Anyhow, they're going to go around to six different places total. And then in 2031, they're going to present it to an international consortium to say, here's the data. We want to repeal the law. And the FAA will stand up and say, yes, yay, verily, this is good. We agree with it. There's an international group that's like the FAA. It's called the ICAO. And they're working on the program as well with NASA. But so by 2031, hopefully we'll have the law repealed and people can then start to design these airplanes. As far as requirements go, I don't want to go through these very much, but again, 75 PLDB is what the airplane has to, it can't be louder than that. It's got to be that or quieter. It's an X plane, but we fly it in national airspace, which is a weird thing for X planes. Usually they just fly around Edwards Air Force Base or some other place where nobody's going to bother them. And if something happens, they won't hurt anybody. In this case, we're going to fly it over Boston or Dallas or other places like that, over you. And it's going to integrate in with the other traffic that's flying in the national airspace. So we have to make it so that it can do that. It does have to be able to fly these community responses. So it's got to be able to take off, fly supersonic, and then come back and do that same supersonic run again. And it's got to be able to do three of them in a day. And to get all that done, it's going to take about 1,000 hours of life. Usually airliners and others are designed for tens of thousands of hours. This one only is designed for 1,000 hours. It's very short life as far as the airplane. It doesn't have to last too long. But again, it can't be a stunt. We can't have something that's a little unmanned airplane that makes a little low boom. We want something that represents a real manned aircraft. So that's why the airplane is the size it is in order to have a person in it. We could have done this with an unmanned airplane. And we need to fly at representative Mach numbers. We need to fly above Mach 1.3. We fly at Mach 1.4. That's as fast as we can go with the engine that we've got. We'd like to go 1.8, but we go 1.4, actually. We go 1.4, but minimum was 1.3. Because 1.3 is, again, above that loud sonic boom. All right, so sonic booms. again, we could talk really technical here, but I made these so that they're not, so that you guys will be experts when you leave here on sonic boom. So here's an F-16, which Lockheed builds. And what we get when the airplane goes supersonic is that it's going faster than the air can actually move out of the way. You've all passed a big truck on the freeway. And you know how when you get sort of almost in front of it, you feel kind of your car move over? That's this big bow wave of air that is pushing out of the way. And when you're going subsonic, like that truck is, you get that where it can push the air out of the way. When you're going supersonic, the air can't get out of the way. And what you do is you create a shock. And it changes the pressure. It also changes the temperature. So as soon as the airplane goes through the air, it's creating this bow shock on the front. When, just like sort of a diver going into the swimming pool, there's the splash that you make when you first go in, and then there's a splash that happens when the water comes back together. And that's the shock on the back end. And so in between, there's other little things that are on the airplane that create their own shock. The cockpit. So we don't have a cockpit because it creates a huge shock. We got rid of it. But the inlet creates a shock. Anything else that's just a change in the airplane, the outside geometry creates a shock. So you want to get rid of those things. But when you hear that boom, you're hearing the first shock, and then you hear the second shock, or the Kerr splash, you know, when you go into, when you throw something in the water or you jump in. And so that's the boom that you hear. But the airplane's flying up at a high altitude, and all those shocks kind of come together as one big shock. It's over a very short period of time. That's why you hear the boom, boom. And it's pretty loud as they all come together. So that's you at the ground, you hear the boom, boom. And so I liken it to a cannonball versus an Olympic diver. All of you are experts on Olympic diving, because what is it that you're looking for? No splash. And that's what we want. You know, cannonball is the opposite of that. It is the biggest splash that you can make, right? And so a lot of airplanes go through the air and they're the cannonball. But what we want to do is we really want to stretch out our fingers and duck our head and get our hands out there and point our toes to make sure that when we go in to the through the air, we make a small splash. And then when it comes together at the end, it's a small splash. I just lost the battery out of here. So remember the analogy of the Olympic diver. So making the airplane, this is kind of why it looks like the way that it does. So if we look at the kind of the silhouette of the airplane from the top, this is taking the airplane as it is, kind of. What we want to do is we want to be like that diver, and we want to stretch it out. We want to have a high fineness ratio, make it really long. So we stretch the airplane out, we get that high fineness ratio. The other thing, if you remember some of the chart that I showed earlier, we want to have this area ruling. So you can see the airplane kind of gets fat and it gets skinny. It gets skinny where the airplane, or where the wing gets fat. And so we need to make sure that we manage how all the volume in the airplane as it progresses through the air. The other thing is that we want the lift to go aft. So you can see this is where the center of lift is right here on this airplane. And we push it aft by moving the wings and the stabilators as far back as we can. We have to move though the center of gravity with it, which means all the heavy stuff has to go to the as far back as we can make it. So that's why the nose is full of nothing. Like, remember I told you it was just 300 pounds for that whole nose. There's just air in there. And the engine is really heavy and it goes as far into the back as we can put it. So we end up with the lift here and we have the center of gravity there. But the other thing is we want to make everything lifting. And you know, we had those stabilators that were in the back. For this airplane to trim, generally stabilators will want to push the nose up and they create anti-lift. They're kind of pushing down, and we don't want that. We want them to be pushing up, but if we push up on those stabilators in the back, it pushes the nose down and the airplane's not flying straight and level. And so for us to lift on the back, what we need to do is lift kind of in the middle or up near the front. And that's why we have the canards. Originally, we tried to make it so that the nose was lifting. It wasn't lifting enough. We needed to have 600 pounds of lift on those canards. So the canards are there to help lift. The T-tail, though, I'll get into that in just a second. It does something else. So here's why the airplane kind of looks like it does. I talked about why we don't have a cockpit to look forward. Again, that's, we want to have that long nose. And that nose is so long that when we come in to land, the nose kind of comes up and we wouldn't be able to see the runway. You guys remember Concorde, and it had a nose that kind of drooped like that when it would take off and land? Our nose is so long that we can't have it droop. We'd just be scraping on the ground. And so what we have is the camera. So we don't have to have that shock of the windscreen, and we don't have to droop the nose because we have this camera. It is a huge enabler. If any future airplane that will go supersonic will have these cameras in it. So just when you're sitting in one, just know that the pilot's actually not looking out where he's going. He's watching a TV. But anyhow, the airplane has a single guy in it. It's 99 feet long. It's 30 foot wingspan. It's 14 feet high. It's 23,000 pounds. The thing that sets the weight of the airplane is that we're using landing gear from an F-16. We can't be any heavier than that landing gear is able to support. And the biggest thing is actually, if we took off with a lot of gas and then came back and had to land immediately without burning the gas, that landing and that impact on the gear is what drives the design of the airplane. So that 24,300 pounds is a hard number. We can't violate it. So as we design the airplane, we keep looking at that weight and making sure that we're not getting any heavier than that. And Mike could tell you this, it's a hard thing to make sure an airplane doesn't grow in weight, just like all of us. It just wants to gain weight. We have 8,700 pounds of fuel that we go around and we burn up in about 90 minutes. We go Mach 1.4 at 55,000 feet, but the airplane can go up to 65. When we're doing these community responses, we will change altitude just to see how it changes the perception of people. If you look at this, the one thing that always kind of bugs me about the airplane, I don't think a lot of you are airplane designers like I am, but it just looks like the landing gear is in the wrong spot. The nose wheel is just so far back, it just doesn't look right. Imagine being in your car and when you steer it, the front steering wheel is in the back so that you're always like moving. Instead of the front turning, it's behind you and it's just steering really weird. But that's how this airplane is. We have a tow bar for this airplane that's sitting in our hangar that is 52 feet long. It's really, really long. And we're just worried about people, you know, as they tow this thing, is it, you know, crunching into hangars or other things like that. We do have a little remote tug with a remote control that can tractor the airplane around. So there's some other features on the airplane. I talked about the windshield. So we don't have a shock that's generated by that. The inlet, we have the inlet on the top of the airplane so that when there's a shock generated, it's going up into space. It's not going down to people on the ground who can hear it. There's a bump on the wing. We didn't talk about it over there, but the bump has an actuator in it. It's kind of a push-pull rod that makes the control effectors go up and down. It's pretty big. And so it doesn't fit in the thin wing. So we have this bump. On a lot of other airplanes, you'll see the bumps on the bottom. We put this one on the top because we don't want a shock going down to the ground. There's kind of a shelf below the engine. And what that does, remember the splash that comes together when the water comes together? We want to mitigate the shock that occurs on the back end of the airplane. We have this little shelf there to help deaden it. But we also have, So the bottom, if you go over and look at the model, there's nothing on the bottom. We want it as clean as possible, but the T-tail. So let me talk about the T-tail. So that when you do a cannonball, the biggest splash really is when the water comes back to the air, you get this kind of go kaboom and this water fountain that goes up in the air. The same thing happens with an airplane. The back end of the airplane is not as clean as the front end. We have this nice pointy nose, but the back end is just this blunt thing where the engine is. So it's a very strong shock. And what that T-tail does is it creates its own shock that basically interferes with that wave that's created by the back end of the airplane. The strength of that shock is still the same, but to your ear, it's been kind of interfered with so that you don't notice it as much. In a swimming pool, when you see all the waves kind of bouncing everywhere and stuff, you really don't see the one wave that's going back and forth because there's other waves that are interfering with it. And that's kind of what that T-tail does. You can move it around, but it doesn't really change the pitch of the airplane. It's just changing the shock that occurs. So we have our cannonball and we have our Olympic diver. So we have this F-16 over there with these big shocks on it. And then we have the X-59 that has stretched things out, has not as strong as shocks, and then shocks that are going up into space. And the other thing is that down on the ground, we have this 100 decibel boom that occurs with the F-16. But on this airplane, what we do with that length, and because we don't have a lot of other little shocks, they don't really coalesce to one big, huge bang. And it's very quiet. Some people call it a thump, or you can call it a thwump or whatever you want, but it's pretty quiet and benign. So where are we with the airplane? There's the airplane in the hangar. This was taken actually back in February. We had taken the engine out and the lower empennage and the stabilators are off of it. It looks a lot different than that right now. The engine's in it and a lot more of the panels are on it, but it is green and black. The black are composite skins. The green is painted aluminum. And then there's some titanium that's silver that's in it. Here's a picture of the airplane when we took it out to Fort Worth. It went out on the road for Christmas of 2001. And it was a very nerve-wracking week for me. I'll just say that there's things that happen when things like this are on the road. There's people, you know, who decide they want to shoot at something or whatever it might be, or throw beer cans at stuff, you know, and we just didn't want anything like that to happen. So we drove mainly at night. It was a huge caravan. There was, when it came back to Palmdale, there was 23 cars and trucks and stuff that were part of this caravan that went with it. This is it in Fort Worth, where we did some structural testing. Basically, we bent the wings and put a lot of forces on it to make sure that it's as strong as we said it was. And so it passed with flying colors. And then right now, let's see if this animation works. Yay. All right. That's like, what are you showing me here? So remember the camera that's on the top that looks out? When that nose comes up, that camera can't see the runway either. And so we have this pop-down forward vision system that allows the pilot to still see down when he's coming in to land and to taxi around on the ground. And so this was the test of the forward vision system about 2 weeks ago, coming down on the front end of the airplane. Putting in a lot of avionics in the airplane, lots and lots and lots of wires. Closing out panels. There's a guy putting a panel on the wing. This is actually where that forward vision system is. If you stood up inside the airplane and looked forward through the nose, that's looking all the way to the front of the nose. It's just hollow. You can see there's a whole bunch of signatures inside there. And so everybody who's been building the airplane has been signing the airplane. There you can see the engine on the airplane, and the stabilators are wrapped with some protective bumpers on them. And then here's the landing gear going up and down. This is about 3 weeks ago. So the airplane has electric power on it, has hydraulic power on it. You've had air going through it. A lot of you will look at this and say, okay, it's landing gear going up and down. To me, this was like, yes, it worked. Because there's a lot of work that went into this. This is an F-16 gear that was designed back in the 70s on drawings, you know, just 2D drawings. And what we got was a copy of a copy of a copy of a drawing where you couldn't read the numbers anymore and things like that. And we're installing this with that kind of stuff from these old landing gear, because this came off of an airplane that was out in a boneyard. This landing gear had been used for decades by an F-16. And like the canopy, how I said it only fit that T-38, this landing gear only fit that F-16 by the time it had, you know, taken off and landed all those years. So when we got it to work, it was a huge triumph. So big deal. Anyhow, so the airplane is moving right along. This is just a list of the companies here in California who have supported us on this program. The list is actually very long of all the companies that have helped out. You all get copies of this, right? Of this. Okay, so if your name is in there or your company is in there, I will just say that we have, the suppliers that we've had have just bailed us out. There's things that have happened and we needed them to redo a part because maybe we damaged it and they came in and fixed it for us or made a new one, and they knew how important this was and they got it done in very short order. So I do want to spend some time here just talking about some lessons learned and some things. All the other stuff is just kind of neat facts, but this is maybe something that you could take away. I'm not sure how it is for you, but if you go and you talk to Boeing and to Lockheed and to Northrop and others, it is really difficult to hire people right now. We employ a lot of purple unicorns and green spotted unicorns, people who have very, very unique talents that not a lot of people are going into college to do those things today. And with people retiring, who are those purple unicorns, and trying to backfill them or to find those people in specialized suppliers or contractors is hard. And that's across industry. You can go and again talk, even at NASA, who's our customer, they have a difficult time filling positions. And so it's hard. The other thing is the X-59 is a one of a kind aircraft. It's not a production run where we have 30 other airplanes that are in the line, or even two others, or one other. If we had one other airplane, it would help us a lot, because when something doesn't fit right or something does get damaged and we need another part, there's another airplane that at least we can steal it from to keep the first one on schedule. But with the one-off airplane, if there's a part that we damage while we're installing it or we need a new one, we have to go to the supplier and ask them to make a brand new one. And they're going to say, well, that's 6 months. Well, we don't have 6 months. And, you know, bad on us for maybe dropping a part or dinging it or drilling it wrong or whatever, but it makes it very hard. The other thing is that if we go to a supplier and say, yeah, we're going to have you make one thing, they're like, well, I'm going to tool for this. I'm going to get all this stuff done and I'm going to make one. No, I'm not going to do it. And so when we first started this, it was very hard to find suppliers who were willing to sign up to make one of something. I will say that we made, I don't have the picture here. We had some really large unitized metallic pieces. And we thought this will be a great way to make parts cheaply. We're gonna make them big and it's gonna be multiple parts, but we're just gonna make one. Great idea for production, but not so much when you're just doing one airplane, because that vendor, when they go to machine that one, there's a lot of learning that they do on that part. And in this case, these were titanium pieces that were 15 feet long, almost 4 feet wide, and about 8 inches thick. And it required the suppliers to machine these for over 2 months with thousands of operations. And if one of them was wrong, it messed up the whole part. And you learn on parts, but when you're only making one, you don't get that chance to learn. And so when you make a mistake, it's really difficult, especially if it's a firm fixed price contract and you say, yeah, I'm going to make this part for you, Lockheed. Oh, I just ruined it. Now you lost all of that money. And so making one off is a hard thing. We don't do this too often, but it does come around a couple times every decade where we just are going to make one, and there are challenges to it. The other thing is implementing new technologies. If we're doing one thing, we don't really want to be the guinea pig for a new technology or a new process or things like that. Yet because we're unclassified, it's an opportunity to actually try things out. So there were things that we tried. One of the big victories here is on the very top picture there. We have something called a Cobra auto drill machine, which on some production floors, you take the part and you bring it to this large machine that then auto drills things. This Cobra is a self-propelled robot, and it comes up to the wing is about a little bit bigger than this whole square that we have here. It came up to the wing and it started just bzz, 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 drilling holes in this thing. I just stood back because it's like having surgery on your grandma, you know, by a robot. You're hoping that everything goes okay. And it did. This robot just blew through these holes in a weekend. And we were going to, if we'd manually done it, it would have taken us about 2 months. And it made about 4 mistakes on the upper surface and 4 on the bottom. And the only reason why is that the skin was just kind of a little bit puckered up above the structure. And so it did a countersink a little bit too deep. But those were minor. And so now we have 8 of these machines at Lockheed. Or I'm sorry, 4 of these machines at Lockheed, and we do all of our airplanes with this Cobra auto drill. Again, it just kind of just comes up and it just drills these and it's done. And yeah, let me just go on here. COVID, I won't go into this. All of you lived COVID, we did, and it was just tough. It was tough with our suppliers. It was tough in our shop. As somebody would get COVID, the whole shop would have to stand down for 10 days, and it was difficult. One of the good things is that we could reuse parts that were out there, the landing gear, the engine, the environmental control system, hydraulic pumps, things like that. Yay, that's great. Bad thing is we were confined to use those. They drive certain requirements or constraints. Like remember the weight of the airplane, we couldn't go above 24,300 pounds because of the landing gear. So there's certain things that it kind of forces you into that are not things that you really wouldn't want to do, but you do them for cost sake. I will say that one of the things that we were able to do on this program that we don't always do on classified programs is be able to use commercial off-the-shelf systems and parts. The cockpit in this airplane is just a dream. The ability to customize it and everything that's in there is just the latest and greatest that aerospace has to offer. And it's just been fun to actually be able to use those things. I will say that with the challenges that have occurred, the relationship that we have had with our customer and with our suppliers has been really the only thing that's bailed us out, is having everybody working together and being very open and transparent about issues, about needs, and having people be able to understand those things quickly to be able to, basically supply with the part or fix the issue. So just real quick, I'll go through this fast. The airplane build is actually done. We're done building the airplane. We're going through and we're doing some testing on it right now. We're gonna move it out to the flight line here in 2 weeks. We're gonna do the ground vibration testing and the structural coupling testing to make sure that it doesn't vibrate in any way that we don't want it to when it's in bumpy air or when landing gear goes down or anything like that. We're gonna paint it. So it's not green and black anymore. And then we're going to start the engine runs and do the integrated ground checkouts later in the summertime. And then we'll go and do taxi tests on the runway in the early fall. And then mid-fall, we'll start flying the airplane. The airplane will fly for about, we think, about 9 months before we hand it over to NASA. Just so you know, first flight is a big deal. After going for years and years working on something, to see it fly is indescribable emotional experience. It's very scary. And then also when it works out, you're just so happy. But in this case, there's something else that happens. And that is about 2.5 months later, we're gonna fly the airplane supersonic. And so the other event that's really unique is we're gonna go up and stand out there at Edwards, and this airplane is gonna fly over. And like the cars out on the freeway, it's going to be this quiet boom. And to me, I've been at first flights before, but this low boom thing is going to be a big deal, because that's the moment that we say that we did it. That's the whole reason why we've gone through this for the last, it's been about 10 years, but 5 years now for the program. So that's really going to be a big deal. So last chart, we've resolved the low boom. We know how to do that. We know how to have forward vision with a long nose. Also, there's an issue with carbon footprint. People say, oh my gosh, you guys are, throwing all this huge carbon footprint, but there is a sustainable aviation fuel that's out there that probably as years go on, you're gonna see more and more use for. The X-59 was originally intended to burn what is called SAF. We're required to burn it, but there was gonna be a change in the engine that was actually unaffordable. Software change that we didn't want to make. So we're not demonstrating that in the aircraft right now. But what's not resolved is we need to get the regulations repealed. That's the whole goal of the airplane. After we do that, how do we integrate in airports with a really long pointy airplane? How do we integrate in the national airspace with subsonic airplanes? They are all flying around at 35 to almost 40,000 feet. We'll be flying around at 50 to 60,000 feet supersonic, which, by the way, is the best flight in the world. There is no turbulence. You're over all the weather. So it's really comfortable. You can totally sleep and not even worry, but you got to come down through it, and you got to come down through all that other traffic. You have to slow down also. So you are going to make a boom at one point, whether you're speeding up or slowing down. So how do you integrate? Are we going to have corridors that allow the airplane to accelerate and make that boom and then go climb out and go supersonic? So, do we pick, Palmdale as the corridor for LA? I don't know. But you have to have these corridors where the airplane can make a boom. There's the takeoff and landing noise at an airport, which is a big deal for subsonic airplanes as well. And then the engine. I spoke to everyone about that when we're over at the model, but there is no engine currently today that flies Mach 1.8 for hours and hours and hours on end without an afterburner. The technology for that has existed since the early 1960s. It's just a matter of us developing it, but it is billions of dollars. The one caveat on this that's a kind of a negative is that I come from a company that makes combat aircraft. There are other countries around the world that make combat aircraft. And if you had an engine that flies Mach 1.8 forever without an afterburner, I'd want that in a military airplane. And so now we have this problem of something that's really good for a commercial airplane, but has a military application. And so we need to work through that. And what is that bridge that we cross, and how do we cross it in terms of the cost, but also the export control on those and the implications of such an engine? Because it would be a game changer for not only commercial aerospace, but also for military. And with that, that is the end. So, okay. I know that we answered a lot of questions over on the airplane. And I know that some questions people had, and I said, well, it's in the charts. So was there anything that we left out or anything that came up? We need a lot of runway. Again, it's the airplane does have flaps, but we do come in pretty fast. The airplane needs, actually, all it needs once it touches down is about 5,000 feet, but that's still, it still needs a mile. In front of that, you need about, anywhere between 1,200 to 2,000 feet of threshold that you go over, and then just any overrun in case of weather or breaking things. And so you're looking at, you know, runways on the order of 10,000 feet. And there's a lot of those around the United States. Most of the airports that you fly out of commercially are around about that big. You mean, is the public going to be invited? So it's going to fly out of Palmdale. And so there's a lot of airplanes that do first flight out of Palmdale. And if you ever go up there during first flight, there's a lot of people that park all around the airport. We probably will be announcing, you know, when we're looking for it. I'll just say that the airplane and the weather set the date. Just like you all saw the Artemis launch and then it didn't launch. When the rocket was ready, it went. And when the weather permitted it, same thing will happen here. There will be a group that's invited to kind of participate in a select area on plant, but otherwise you can see it. I think that NASA will televise it live. I know that we're gonna have a rollout ceremony that NASA is gonna televise live. So, other questions? Yeah. So it's not a hard choice, it's money. It is. There are certain things that just cost a lot of money. And money is also time. So if there's like landing gear, if we design new landing gear, it would take years to have that landing gear made because the tooling is, they're usually forgings. They're very expensive tooling. And so that's really how we do it. It's just what's gonna take a lot of time. So when you look at the airplane, a lot of the subsystems, you know, the environment, the air conditioner, the environmental control system, the avionics, pumps, valves, the engine, the landing gear, the flight computer, that kind of hardware, we just buy it or just go steal it off an airplane. Just a real quick anecdote. So if you ever go up to Lockheed and you're going to go through the front gate, we have some gate guardians. There are airplanes that are there. That some of them are from the 50s. There's an F-16 from it was made in the 70s. Our landing gear comes from an F-16, and there was a part that we needed, and it was going to take us 21 weeks to get the part. But we had the part sitting on the airplane that was out front at the gate. And so fortuitously, that airplane was owned by NASA. If you go up there, you'll see NASA logo on the side. So we asked NASA, hey, can we have the part off this airplane? And they wrote us a letter saying, have at it. So some technician or some mechanics went out there with their tools, tore the part off the airplane, and we stuck it on ours. So anyhow, Mike is probably cringing at that. I mean, there were some things, some processes that had to go through, but it was still good and flight worthy. Almost, it came off the landing gear. What it was a little valve for the hydraulics that make the landing gear go up and down. And we just took that valve off of the thing. So you had a question? Right. So to the first question, talking about fatigue, right, on the T-tail. There's not a lot of buffet going along that's up there on the T-tail. It's in pretty clean air, and it's creating a shock that is trailing behind it that then interacts with the shock that's trailing behind the trailing edge. So all of that turbulence is behind the airplane. So it's seeing pretty clean air. With respect to SpaceX and Elon Musk's vision, you know, there's a lot of things. If you look in the news, there's people who say, hey, we're going to fly hypersonic. And then they show a picture of a hypersonic airliner. There's still people showing pictures of supersonic airliners. We have not gotten to a supersonic airliner yet. So talking about a hypersonic airliner is even farther out there. And using the Starliner to go around the world, again, that's one of those things where SpaceX will probably need to explode and crash dozens of these to prove that they're safe. And then they're going to have to start, you know, putting people in them, just like they did with, Falcon or Dragon? Falcon. I think that the price of those tickets, if they do happen, will be very expensive, because you're burning lots of fuel to do something that just takes a short amount of time. And there's just a lot of risk in it. I mean, even going to the space station and coming back today, you know, we had the space shuttle fly for decades, and yet we did lose two of them. You know, it just happens. I think that this is one of those things that will be more affordable. And so it would be competitive. I mean, to me, I think that the other one is more of a stunt. You know, we have people who go into, you know, up into space and stuff right now and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to do it, but it is a stunt. It's not something that's practical yet. That's just my thought. There is, but I'll just say that, you know, so airport noise and regulations for noise is a sore spot. There's a lot of people who just don't want to hear it. If, you know, there's a reason why at the end of runways, there's nobody who lives there, or else there's cemeteries, you know. You go down to Burbank and the cemetery is right there. You know, you go down to LAX and it's all the homes that were supposed to be there. If you fly over, you see all these empty roads. Nobody lives there. It is loud. I lived next to an airport when I was a kid that had fighters taking off and landing, and I got used to it. And I thought it was cool because I just like airplanes. There's other people who hate it. When an airplane is coming into land, even if you were to shut the engines off so there's no engine noise, the air on the flaps and landing gear and everything else creates lots of noise in the hundreds of decibels. As you get away from the airplane, you don't hear it as much. But if any of you remember when you were a kid, the old windows that had the little triangular pieces that would open up, you could let air in, and they would like whistle, you know, the airplane is just full of all sorts of those whistling things. And it's very hard to control those. It's hard to make an airplane quiet when you're, you know, without an engine, it's still making noise. But these large fans that they have on these airplanes, these jet engines, are actually pretty quiet. But when they take off, they're at full throttle, and they have to throttle back and stuff as they take off, and the noise then starts to broaden or go out farther. And so they have a certain throttle schedule that they have to follow and try to mitigate the noise. With this airplane, the issue is that the engine doesn't have a big fan that's quiet. It has a smaller fan that's more shrill, and controlling that noise will be an issue. There are technologies that are out there to help reduce those sounds, but it is an issue that we're going to have to work through. At least we won't be an afterburner. We won't be like the Concorde, where, I mean, literally 5 miles away, you hear this thing going, you know, as these engines light up. You had a couple of questions? Mm-hmm. Yep. They don't have an engine. They haven't had an engine for years. It is. I know that they have talked about... So when they started out, they were above Mach 2. And I've been on panels with the guy who's over that company. And I presented that, hey, the sweet spot's 1.8. Above that, it's too expensive. They came down to the 1.6, 1.8 range, which is good. And so they don't have to be an afterburner, but the engine is just not there. There is no engine. And so it is a problem. So I'm going to, you guys can't repeat this. So UFOs are silent. And so we use that technology for low boom. So I'm lying. So here's my, we're way out here. Okay. And I'm just going to give you my opinion. How much does it cost for us to go to Mars? So many billions that right now we don't even know how much it is. And as a nation, let alone as a species of all humanity on this planet, paying for the bill to send just a few people to Mars and the risk of going that far and the catastrophes that could happen between here and there and the redundancies of the spacecraft, because you can't get spare parts. If something breaks, you need to bring it with you. So you're actually bringing so much stuff with you just in case that the spacecraft and everything else is hugely redundant. In old sailing ships, you know, 400 years ago, they brought a carpenter along with them, and they would go places and they would rebuild the ship. They would actually take it out of the water as Captain Cook sailed around the world. You know, they would rebuild the ship. For us to fly to, for somebody to fly to another planet, another solar system, you know, and it take hundreds of years or whatever it is, and to come and to, you know, abduct people and to look at cows and to point, you know, poke at things, and then to be secret about it, you know, and to hide places, the economics and the technology required to do that require the will and all of the capital of an entire planet. What I'm saying making sense to you? I mean, it's not like these small little spaceships go, you know, between the stars and they just go there instantly. There's physics. Unless, you know, somebody figures out how to go through wormholes and how much energy that takes. So for me, rest assured, when I first went to work for Lockheed, I thought, well, I want to look at all these things that came from Area 51 or whatever it was. And I'll just tell you that there's no UFOs, but there are some really, really cool, amazing, smart people that have ideas and things that the government and others have funded and realized that that make this country very proud of what we have accomplished. A lot of it is in the name of defense, and we have fought wars that never happened because of certain technologies that were developed that our adversaries were aware of, and they're just basically like, okay, we're done. Walls fell and other things happened because the taxpayers and just very smart people were able to develop things that just are incredible. And they are today. There's things that are out there, and we have countries that just spend as much as they can to try to figure out what it is that we're working on. Does that kind of answer your question? Yep. Yep. Yeah. So I could go on for a lot of comments and stuff about things that fly, and the also just camera optics and how things look photographed versus in reality of what they look like. Again, you saw that one of my hobbies is photography and astrophotography. And I photographed a lot of things that's like, oh my gosh, this is what it is, you know. And when the reality of a lot of things that you think are really super cool or really weird, if you really find out what they are, it's like very disappointing. Any last questions? All right. Well, thank you for inviting me.
I want to thank David. That was old school talk. That was really cool. So unique. Great to hear. I have an engineering degree. I learned things. So I actually done some work on F-16 landing gear. So that's fantastic. Yeah. So, well, we rebuilt it, made some. But I get it. So thank you so much. All right. Oh, we did the Q&A. So wrap up here. We've got some upcoming meetings. So second half outlook in a couple of days. Actually, it's tomorrow. For aerospace and defense. Again, that's what this forum is about. Learning, education, aviation defense markets, what lies ahead. Richard, I believe, works for Ad Week, May 19th, June 1, panel on digital transformation. Let's see, we've got a tour. Our next event is a tour, an aircraft component repair with Dennis. Dennis couldn't make it today. He had a customer visiting. That's an acceptable excuse. And then we're going to the benefits of AI. A lot of stuff in the news about AI recently. We've got a Ab Week meeting July 6th and July 19th, market trends and valuation. In general, we'll have events coming up here every month. August 16th, summary of the Paris Air Show. And then November, Joanna Doolittle Hopps, author of Calculated Risk. I was watching a thing on PBS last night about the Doolittle Raiders, and it was amazing. So, about what they accomplished. And so if you want to join or you haven't joined, $250 a year, you can go to any forum, any of our 9 forums. And if you're not relatively near, membership is free. This recording, along with all the prior recordings, is on the website. You can join the mailing list for free. You can get the A&D monthly forum newsletter. Always welcome to sponsor one of the meetings or one of the chapters. And again, we'll make copies of these business cards and send them out to everybody that's attended. So thank you to everyone that attended. And again, thank you to David and Holly, Calvin and Sue. And if people want, I guess you probably have a few more minutes here to network, and hopefully we'll see you next month.
Such an honor having your presentation. It's really cool, especially the aerodynamics that you were explaining. Very concise, very informative, very simple. No one can be able to. And the question was, you